All right, so welcome back to those of you who were here yesterday, and welcome to those of you who came to the session today for the first time. We're gonna focus today on choosing a machine learning algorithm. We're not gonna spend too much time on specific algorithms. I will provide you with some resources for looking at very specific algorithms and comparisons. But really what I want to draw your attention to today is what are the things that we should be thinking of when we think about choosing a machine learning algorithm. What are all the considerations that should go into that decision? Okay. So there's a little cheat sheet in the slides that will be shared with you. And you can take a look at the cheat sheet. It kind of covers sort of in a brief overview of some of the things we're going to talk about today. But a couple of things that I want to mention is machine learning is, you may have heard this before, it's part art and part science. It's a balancing act. Some of the decisions that we make when we think about choosing a machine learning algorithm have less to do with the optimization or the technical aspects of machine learning algorithm and more to do with business decisions. Other decisions are more kind of like you let the mathematics and the algorithms do the tricks, right? So that's definitely something to kind of keep in mind as we talk today. Another thing to kind of consider is that, you know, there's kind of a warning, right? Because we're talking about a balancing act, because we have part art, part science, there is no one solution or one approach. Some problems are very specific, and because of that, they require a kind of a unique approach. If you think about something like a recommender system, right, that's a very common type of machine learning algorithm, and it solves a very specific kind of problem. Other problems are very open, right? When we talk about some of the algorithms that I talked about yesterday, supervised learning algorithms, regression and classification, these are very open problems. They could be used in anomaly detection. They could be used to build more general sorts of predictive models. And because of that, we have different approaches that we can take, and each approach has sort of its pros and cons, its benefits and its disadvantages. So what we're going to talk about today is kind of like a starting point, right? But it's very much sort of up to trying different things and seeing what works and what doesn't work. So let's cover sort of the short answer, right? If you, I don't want you to walk out after this slide, but I want to sort of offer you the short answer of what the next hour is going to be about, right? So let's start at the top, right? The choice of a model is affected and affects a bunch of things, starting with the business goal, right? So we should always try to start with some kind of question that we're trying to answer, right? And we should ask if the model that we choose is going to help us answer this question. The next thing we're going to be doing is we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about pre-processing. Right? This is something that we sort of briefly went over yesterday as well, but today maybe we'll talk about it in a little bit more detail. And that has to do with the fact that we have some data, but we need to do things to the data before we plug it into a machine learning algorithm. And all of the work that we do on the data to get it ready for machine learning is referred to in general as pre-processing. Okay. We might be wondering, how accurate is this model, right? For most people, that's probably the most important thing. If we don't have a model that is making good predictions, that's not a very accurate model, and so we probably don't care to use it. So accuracy is very important, but it's by far not the only important thing. It's not the end of all, right? Another thing we might be considering is explainability, right? Is this a model that I can then take and explain to other people, right? Other people might be other people in our business group, people who don't necessarily have a training in machine learning or statistics. Other people might be our customers, right? So the ability to be able to explain a model, the interpretability, it's kind of a tongue twister, the interpretability of a model, the explainability of a model is very important as well. And as we're going to see, explainability and accuracy kind of go in opposite directions. So we're talking about a trade-off. We're talking about choosing more simple models that are more explainable but maybe less accurate, or more complex models that are hard to explain but do a better job of predicting. And then the last things to consider are things that have to do with how the model is going to be used. So the deployment of the model, again, another one of those things that is becoming more and more important. 10 years ago, data scientists didn't really think about that too much. They sort of just built models and used them most of the time on their own laptops. But now we're talking about models being being sort of the back end of different applications, being on the web and so on. And because of that, the deployment of the model is also an important consideration. Right. So I have three colors here, and the three colors are going to delineate sort of the hierarchy of things. And we can see that in the next chart. So notice we start at the bottom. We talk about sort of let's see what sort of business question we're trying to answer. Let's see what sort of data we have. Let's see what are the things that we need to do to clean up our data before we do any modeling. And that's kind of in a gray area: business understanding, and data preparation. And that kind of ties back to the last slide. Right, we're trying to build a model, and we should start with a business question, and we should start with also the available data and our understanding of the data. Right? So these are pre-modeling tasks, right? But they just because they're pre-modeling tasks, it doesn't mean that we should not worry about what we have to do. We should not worry about our model when we're pre-processing it. Right, so the choice of a model is to some extent affected by the way that we're going to answer a particular business question and the way that we're going to pre-process the data. Then we have some tasks that are actually relevant to the process of modeling, right? And you can see that in blue here. We're talking about training models. And this has to do with just trying different things, right? Some problems are very specific. We really choose like a specific model. We might still be interested in finding ways of tuning it. Other problems can be approached using different models, and there is some trial and error involved. And because of that, the task of modeling is one where you have the part art, the part science sort of coming together, right? So that's shown in blue here. And finally, we have deployment or consumption of the model at the very top in sort of a purple shade. And that in the last slide, that ties into questions such as how fast is this model supposed to be in production? Right? When we talk about sort of fast models, we have two sorts of things to consider. How fast is it to actually build a model? Right? That's usually something that is important, but we can be a little bit more patient, but how fast is the model when you deploy it to make predictions is really important, because if the model is a very accurate model but it's slow in production, right, that's something that's going to come back to kick us. Right? Another thing that we consider in a production environment is scalability. Right? Scalability doesn't necessarily have... Well, it could be tied, but it's not necessarily related to how fast the model is. It's related to how well it performs when you feed it more and more data. Right? In the big data world, we kind of always have to have in the back of our mind, even if right now we don't have a lot of data, we should be prepared to know how well our models are going to perform if the size of our data increases a lot in the near future. Okay, so that was the high-level overview, and here's the agenda. So we're going to try to get ready by just establishing some base rules. We're going to talk about choosing and tuning models. Right? deploying models, and we'll finish by just talking about the data science lifecycle, right? What does it look like when we do data science in practice? Okay, so you might have seen this yesterday. Right? It's a review for some of you, and this is sort of the process of doing data science. Right, we start with the gray area. Again, this gray is the same gray that we saw in the last slide. Right, it's our sort of starting with a business problem, going and looking at the data, understanding the data, and preparing the data for the model. And in this slide, it's shown in on the left side of the screen as defining our objectives, going and getting the data, and pre-processing the data. So this is what we're going to talk about now. Right? It's very important for us to know our data. Right? The way that we know our data is we look at summary statistics, we look at visualizations. Once we know the data, and once we have some idea of the kinds of models that we're going to build, then we can look at cleaning our data, right? So this involves the process of like deciding to handle our missing values, right? Again, we should always be prepared for missing data. It's very common to have missing information in our data, missing rows of data. And we need to know what we want to do with those. Same thing with our outliers. Right? And we also need to decide if the data needs to be aggregated at a less granular level than it is now. And finally, the big one is feature engineering, augmenting our data. Right? So let's start by knowing our data. Okay, so we can look at some summary statistics. Right? And we don't necessarily have to be statisticians to have an understanding of the data. Probably everyone in this room is very comfortable with things like averages. There are more to statistics than looking at averages. It's probably a good idea to know some basic statistics to look at, things like standard deviation. What do we think of when we think of standard deviations? Things like medians, ways of detecting outliers, looking at percentiles, and then some basic visualizations. Box plots can be really helpful. Density plots can be really helpful. Right? We want to know for all of the columns in our data, are they missing? For what reason? What is the average? Is the average high? Does it make business sense? Right. So taking our data, asking questions about it, and being able to occasionally go back to IT, for example, and say, hey, I noticed that this particular column has a very high average. Is there a reason for that? It doesn't really make business sense in my head. So knowledge of our data. Then we talk about cleaning our data, right? Handling our missing values is very important. Now, very important here is kind of subjective. It depends on the model that we're going to choose, right? Some models are very good at, for the most part, very good at handling missing data. Other models are very sensitive to them, right? So when it comes to dealing with our data, when it comes to pre-processing, it's always good to know ahead of time what kind of models we're going to build, and based on that, have an idea of the kind of pre-processing that we're going to have to do on the data, right? So pre-processing, in this case, processing missing values, the topic of missing value imputation, that is the idea of going to the data and replacing missing values with, in some very basic cases, averages. In some more complicated cases, we come up with fancy ways of replacing missing values. But all of that is going to affect the model that we're going to build. And the model that we choose is also going to affect how much we're going to spend time pre-processing our data. Outliers, same kind of idea. Outliers are in some cases important, in other cases not important. It depends on the model that we're going to build, and it depends to some extent of what the outliers represent. If you think of something as anomaly detection, right, we're talking about going to our data and finding observations that are not supposed to happen, observations that are really strange or very unusual. In the case of anomaly detection, a good case is fraud detection, right? A fraudulent transaction is a transaction that happens, but it's fraudulent, it shouldn't be happening, and we want to be able to detect that. Well, you could easily argue that a fraudulent transaction is an outlier, right? It's an outlier in the data. It's something that breaks the usual trend in the data. But it's definitely not the kind of outlier that we want to clean or throw away, because it's exactly what we're interested in. It's what we're trying to capture. And so in that sense, for something like anomaly detection, an outlier is exactly what we're interested in. In other cases, outliers are really just noise. They just get in the way. This is especially true if we have a bad data collection process going on. In some cases, a lot of values enter the data because they were wrongly entered, or because there was just a problem with the collection process. And so we have a lot of noise in the data, and they don't really make sense. Right? In a fraudulent transaction, an outlier actually represents somebody committing fraud. Right? So this is not necessarily something that relates to data collection. It's not a wrong input to the data. It's just it's basically being able to detect something that really happened but that you want to prevent. In other cases, it's very common to have outliers that are just really adding noise to our models. And once again, just like missing values, some models are not very sensitive to outliers. More specifically, tree models tend to be less sensitive to the presence of outliers. So if you're going to mostly be dealing with trees, you probably don't care as much about the outliers. If you're going to build regression models, any models that try to use equations, we tend to be careful about the outliers. They could definitely affect, in some cases, our models. Okay, aggregation is another topic, right? And that definitely goes back to the sort of business question that we're trying to answer. Raw data is usually very granular in its more granular form. And very often, the business questions that we're trying to answer don't go back to that level of granularity. And so it's common to have to aggregate the data at some level before we build a model using the data. Okay, augmenting your data. I use the word augment here, as in you have your original data, right? That's the data that you currently have. But using your original data, very often we can extract a lot of useful features from the data. It's very common, for example, in the original data to have something like date time. Well, date time is very good. It's very specific. It says, for example, that for a credit card transaction, here is the date and the time that the transaction happened. But for models, date time is not always useful. Time series models can use datetime in its raw format, but a lot of models don't really know how to deal with a datetime column. It's so specific. On the other hand, if you have a datetime column, you can extract a lot of useful features. An example of that is just day of the week, right? It may not be very helpful for a model to know the exact day and time that something happened, but knowing that it happened on a Monday is an important piece of information. Knowing that it happened in October is really good for models to know. So we start with data in its raw format, information as it's available to us now. But when we augment our data, when we do feature engineering, part of that is just deciding what are information that we can extract from the raw data so that this information can be more useful to the models than the original information in the data. Right? That's one kind of feature engineering. There's other kinds of feature engineering. I kind of talked about that somewhat yesterday. But every model is going to somewhat impose a certain amount of feature engineering on our part. And again, what we do to our data, how much feature engineering we have to do to the data depends partly on the models that we choose. Okay, now we come to, I guess, what you could say the funner part, right? We've sort of have our data, we've done, we have an idea of the kinds of models that we want to build, and we come to the next phase, we cleaned our data, we handled our missing values and so on, and we're ready to do some modeling, right? And yesterday we talked about the fact that we have to train and test our models. Training means that we use a portion of the data, the larger portion of the data, to build the models. Testing means that we set aside a smaller portion of the data to evaluate the models, right? If a model is really good, it shouldn't be good at making predictions on the data that it used to learn from. It should be good at making predictions on data that it wasn't using to learn from, right? That's when you can really test how well a model is doing. And so that's the goal yesterday, the goal of doing this, right? So more abstractly, we're going to start with the question of what exactly is a model, right? It's kind of this word that we throw around a lot, right? And for me, this is the way I think about it. A model is really just a simplification, right? If we think of data, data is very complex. Data is noisy. And there are relationships going on, but those relationships tend to be pretty complex, right? And when we try to model something, we're trying to say, I don't want to look at individual data points to understand what's going on. It's impossible to do that. There are millions of data points and lots of columns and rows. I want to come up with a simplification of the kinds of things, the kinds of relationships that are in the data. Right. So a model is really a simplification of something more complex. Because of that, statisticians sometimes use this quote, all models are wrong, but some are useful. All models are wrong in the sense that at the end of the day, every model is going to take something extremely complex and simplify it. And in that sense, you always lose something, right? There is some amount of complexity, some amount of relationship that we fail to capture because we are trying to simplify things. But some are useful. Now, what is useful? Well, that depends. Useful could be useful in the sense that it's making good predictions, so accuracy. Useful could be useful in the sense that we can understand it, explainability. Useful in the machine learning world is useful in the sense maybe that it's fast at making predictions. It can make predictions in a timely manner, right? Because if we have a good model in the sense of accuracy and explainability, but if the model in production takes a day to come up with predictions and that's too late for us, then that's not a very useful model, right? So with that, we're going to focus, I'm using the word model here in kind of a broad sense, but from now on, we're really gonna talk about predictive models, right? For the most part, when we think of models, we talk about predictive models, right? Predictive models is just another name for the supervised learning algorithms that I introduced yesterday. So a good predictive model, as we talked about, is one that's accurate, interpretable, fast, scalable. Accuracy and interpretability have to do with the specifics of the model itself, right? Fast and scalable have to do with the way that the model is being deployed, right? What's fast in one setting may not be fast in another setting, right? It depends on how the model is being used. Then we have this idea of model complexity, right? Well, that's another one of those things that's a little bit hard to understand. What exactly is model complexity, right? And we're going to look at some examples a little bit later today, right? I think I'll reserve maybe the last 20 minutes or so of the class to just look at maybe two examples of some of the concepts that we cover in these slides. But one way to think about complexity is complexity could really just be the opposite of explainability, right? If something is very difficult to explain, then we can say it's probably complex, right? Most complex models are very hard to understand. My previous speaker was talking about black boxes, right? These black boxes are sort of the underlying thing behind a lot of complex models. If we think about deep learning is amazing in terms of being able to make accurate predictions. Deep learning is not necessarily the best model if you try to understand how the predictions are coming about. If you want to come up with a simple equation that's going to describe the predictions, in deep learning, that's not going to happen. Equations do exist, but they're extremely complicated. If you try to understand it in terms of something like a decision tree, again, it's possible, but it's very complex trying to understand it. Same thing with the tree models. One decision tree is very explainable. It's very easy to understand it. All you have to do is just look at it. Now, the tree itself might be very long and very deep, right? But it's still a single tree. But if you talk about some of the ensemble models, such as random forests and boosted decision trees, there are multiple trees being built. Now you lose the ability to really explain things. You have many trees going on, and just being able to understand it is more complicated. Complexity may also have to might also be affected by the pre-processing that we do on the data. Right? Sometimes we have to run feature engineering on the data. In the process of doing that, we might have to do something like standardizing our columns. So a lot of the time, feature engineering might take something, a model that usually is simple, but just make it more abstract, more difficult to understand. Another way to think of complexity, and this is kind of important, once again, going back to the way that the model is used in production, is just the computational overhead. Right? More complex models have more computational overhead. Deep learning, again, is an example of that. If you want to do deep learning, you're probably going to have to use GPUs. Right? CPUs just don't cut it anymore. Even with more simple models, such as random forests, such as boosted trees, such as any models that fall into the category of what we call ensemble models, there is a lot of computational overhead for being able to do something as simple as a single prediction. On the other hand, models such as linear models are very fast, very efficient, right? So they're less complex. So it's kind of just three different ways of looking at complexity. Right? Complexity is the opposite of explainability. Complexity has to do with computational overhead. Complexity has to do occasionally with the amount of pre-processing that we have to do on the data before we run the model. Right. And complexity is also going to be relevant when we talk about the same model. Right? So one way of looking at complexity, in the last slide, we were talking about complexity in terms of different models, right? I compare one model, such as deep learning, to one model, such as a linear model. And they have some things in common, but they're very, fundamentally, they're very different kinds of models, and one is much more complex than the other one. But now we're going to talk about complexity within the same model, because that's also true. You can have a single linear model, and make it more complex by basically adding more features to the model. You can have, for the case of linear models, you can have what's called polynomial features, or you can have interactions between features in the model. That makes it more complex. In the case of a decision tree, a complexity of a tree has to do with the depth of the tree. A simple tree might be very short, and the decision might be very simple. A more complex tree is going to be a big tree that spans over multiple depths, and in that sense, it's more complex. Right? So yesterday we saw that if we have more complex trees, we tend to run the risk of overfitting. That is, we're going to have a model that's going to look like it's doing really well, but when we actually go and look at the error on the test data, that model is going to to run bad predictions. It's going to have a high error, right? So complexity for the same model has to do with this chart that we're looking at, and we saw that yesterday. I bring it up here today again because it's really probably like one of the most important charts in machine learning, right? So take a model, and as you make it more complex, you're going to eventually hit a wall. You want to be somewhere in the middle of this chart. That's when you have models that do the best job of generalizing. Those are the models that do the best job of running good predictions on out-of-sample data. Right? So the topic of complexity in this case has to do with how do we fine-tune our models? How do we take the same model, such as a linear model or a tree, explore different possibilities and come up with a model that is not too simple, not too complex? I think one of my favorite quotes by Einstein is models have to be simple but not simplistic. right? And it's sort of the same idea. It's you want simplicity because simplicity, especially for, I guess this was a quote from Einstein, and for physicists, simplicity is really important because they need to be able to explain things. It's not enough to have a model that does great predictions. If you're a physicist, you're very interested in explaining what's going on, defining it in terms of simple mathematical relationships, right? So we want simplicity, but we don't want them to be simplistic. Simplistic means it's just not capturing enough information. It's not complex enough for us to make it a useful model. Simplistic models would be on the very left side of this chart. Okay, so we'll see more examples of this idea of complexity when we run some of the examples in Azure Machine Learning. Okay. Now, for the different models, it's as you can see in this chart, we have some examples, but there is a little warning, and I would caution you to pay attention to the warning, especially since I'm not necessarily an expert in machine learning. I don't consider myself an expert in machine learning. But overall, we seem to agree on the idea that, yes, some models are more complex than others. And when we look at models in terms of accuracy versus interpretability, so interpretability is just explainability of the model, we end up with sort of a spectrum, right? Notice that deep learning is at the very bottom on the right side of the spectrum, right? So deep learning models, and right above it, you can see random forests. Those are models that are very complex because we have a very hard time explaining them, but they're very accurate. They make very good predictions. So in that sense, if you don't care about interpretability, if you don't care about explainability, and you just want to be accurate, all you have to do is just use those models. On the other hand, if you do care about interpretability, then you're going to suffer. What you suffer is in terms of accuracy. You're going to build models. They're going to be less accurate, less able to predict well, but they're going to be more explainable, right? And in some cases, as we said, explainability is a big deal for a business to be able to explain, not just to be able to make predictions, but to be able to explain how the predictions came about something that we might really care about. And then we have a bunch of things there in the middle that are algorithms that could be maybe not too bad in terms of accuracy, not too bad in terms of explainability. So it's kind of this chart kind of gives you a mental picture of the things that we could be doing. And as we decide on our models, we should be wondering, we should be asking the question, how much do we care about explainability? How much do we care about making accurate predictions? And where do we want to be on a chart like this? So we looked at pre-processing our data, getting the data ready. We looked at building different models, experimenting, trying one model versus another, asking questions such as, how complex do we want to be when we talk about a single model? Like for the same algorithm, for the same decision tree, how complex of a decision tree do we want to build? And then we looked at complexity as in comparing different models to each other. Right? And at this point, we have a model, we're ready to use it, right? But once again, when it comes to production, we need to be asking those questions not after we finish modeling, but before we do anything. Is if we choose a model that's very accurate, how well is it going to perform in production, right? And so this is where we are now. We're in the production phase, and we're going to look at our model in terms of how the model is being consumed. Can it be fast? Can it be scalable? And if so, is this a good model in terms of accuracy? Can I use this in production in a way that could really build my solution well? Okay, so those are really the main considerations that go into building a model. We're going to look at some examples a little bit later so that you can see in practice the sorts of some of these ideas as implemented in Azure ML. But what I want to draw your attention to now is basically this idea of the data science lifecycle. Right? So notice that I said at the beginning that these are really some of the most important considerations that go into choosing models. Right? And at the top, it says that the choice of a model affects these considerations, but it's also affected by these considerations. And what I mean by that is probably best personified in the next slide when you look at the chart on the right. Right. So this is the life cycle of a data science project. Life cycle as opposed to workflow, because workflow kind of sort of pushes the idea that you have a starting point, you do something, you do something, you do something, and you have an end point and you're done. But most of the time in practice when we do data science, that's not what happens. We have a starting point and we kind of have an ending point. The starting point is our business objective. You can kind of see that at the top of the chart where we define our goal. The end point is probably the one right to the left of it where it says deploy model. Right? So we start with a business goal and we have some kind of deployment in mind. When it's done, that's what we hope to see. But as you can see in the chart, there's arrows going around and there's arrows going back and forth between each of these places. Right? So when we define a business objective, we're going to go and look at the data that we have. And it could be that we realize that the data is probably not going to answer the business objective that we have in mind. Right? So we have a problem. We go back to business and we say, hey, we need to be more realistic about the sorts of business objectives that we meet, about the sorts of questions that we can answer, because we just don't have the data for it in this case. Same thing with the process of going from the data to the models. We might have data and we go to build models with it and we realize that the data is really, really noisy. The models that we build are not really good. And so we can go back to our data collection and we can say, can we do a better job of collecting data? Can we make the data less noisy? Right? So a lot of interaction going on between sort of what kind of data we have and what kind of models we can build, or how good the models are that we can build with them. Right? We might build models and then go to the next step of evaluating the models. And in the process of evaluating them, we're going to see that some of the models are not really good. So we're going to go back and we're going to do this thing of fine-tuning our models and coming up with models that are complex enough that they can capture meaningful relationships, but not too complex that they're not very good at generalizing to our overall data. We might go to the step of evaluating models and choose a model and then go to present the results, right? And realize that there is a lag between sort of the models and how well they work and the fact that they're just not fast or they're not scalable. They don't do the job in when we look at the deployment. Or maybe the models are too complex, right? We didn't think about complexity. We go to business, we present a model, and somebody says, well, I need to understand how this thing is working, and we just don't have a good explanation, right? Because we focused on accuracy at the expense of complexity, right? Lastly, yeah, same thing with deployment. We're going to deploy our model and realize that these models are just not doing a good job in a deployment scenario. We didn't think about scalability. We didn't think about how fast the models can make predictions. And because of that, because we only focused on, let's say, accuracy, or we only focused on some other aspect, it turns out that we have great models, but they're not very useful in production. So this is really, I mean, these arrows are pointing back and forth in every direction, because that's really what happens. In practice, we start with data, we end up building a solution. But at the end of the day, we should be at least taking the time to go back to square one and wonder, what can we do differently? How can we make this more smoother? How can we improve our data? How can we improve our models? And how can we build better solutions? So this iterative process of data science is really what data science is like in most real-life applications. So I guess I can ask, are there any questions? Raise your hand if you have questions. Well, raise your hand so I can see that you can raise your hands. Okay, so most of you cannot raise your hands. That explains a lot of things. Okay, so we're gonna look at two examples, and these examples are on the gallery. So if you were able to log into the Azure ML Studio yesterday, you can run these examples as well. And they save us a lot of time because I don't want to have to. Yesterday we kind of started from scratch and we built a lot of different kind of scenarios, and it takes time to drag and drop these things. So instead of doing any of that today, I just want to go and look at some pre-built examples that we can run in the studio and see what they're doing. So the first one is going to be this solution called clustering, finding similar companies. So I'm going to go, if you want to see how to find the solution, all you have to do is come here in the Azure ML Studio. You click on a new experiment, and if you just type cluster or clustering, the one in the middle is called clustering, finding similar companies. And we can go and open that in the studio. Well, I think I already had it open, but it's going to reopen it anyway. And if we zoom out on this thing, we're going to see that there are quite a few pieces to this thing. So we start with some data as usual, and we're going to do some processing on that data, and we're going to build some kind of model. In this case, this is the data that we have, the raw data. So I'm going to click on the data, right-click on the data, and visualize it. So it looks like we have only three columns in the data, and we have about 500 rows. The three columns contain a title, which if we scroll down, we can see that's the name of a company. And based on the histogram, you can tell that every company is represented once. Right, so every row is one company. Then we have a category column. The category seems to be the industry that the company falls into. Right? And the last one is some raw text. And this raw text was pulled out of Wikipedia. Right? And it's just a description of the company, a very brief description of each of these companies. So that's it. We have raw data. It contains three columns: the name of the company, the industry that the company is in, and some raw text. Now, raw text, as it turns out, is not a great input to any of the major models. Right? When we have raw text like this, we can't just take this and feed it to a model. It's not going to do a good job. This is an example of data that is too granular, and we have to find a way to make it less granular. Okay? And fortunately, in a lot of these text analytics applications, we don't have to do too much. We can just rely on already existing algorithms to get it done. So there is a feature hashing, and I should probably run, well, let me just run the selected. For now, I can run it piece by piece. There is a feature hashing algorithm in Azure ML, and what it's going to do is it's going to take this raw text and it's going to extract features from it. When we run it and look at the data, we're going to see that in addition to the three columns that we started with, we now have something like over 4,000 new columns. Okay. So something happened. It looks like it's magical. We don't necessarily have to understand all the ins and outs of what's going on. But now we have a bunch of features. Let's see what these features look like. Right? We can look at a histogram. Right? And we can see that the majority of the cases, the features seem to be very small, very small numbers. And in some cases, they go up to, in this case, 7.1, 14.2, and around, let's say, 50 or so, they kind of stop. Same sort of idea with the next one, and so on. So we have some kind of number. In this case, the number is 31, 19, and so on. We have some kind of number, And this number represents one of the features that we extracted from the text. Right? They're very abstract. Right? It's possible for us to try to understand what these numbers represent, but we're not going to do that. Right? Instead, we're just going to kind of take it for granted, but we want to see what exactly, how exactly these numbers are going to be used in the next step. Right? So we have raw text, and somehow, almost magically, we were able to extract a bunch of features from the raw text. These features represent certain aspects of the text, certain dimension in the text, probably something with the way that words appear in the text, right? And we have lots of them because we have lots of words in the raw text. And so really what these features represent, at least as far as we're concerned, is some kind of idea of the sorts of information that we can find in the raw text. So I'm going to move to the next one, and I'm going to run it. The next one is really just, okay, let me just run the whole thing to make it easier. But the next one is really just some R code. The R code is going to do some kind of analysis for us. Right. Okay, we already finished. It runs pretty quickly. Right. And again, I don't want to spend too much time on the specifics, but the idea here in the R code is that we're going to basically run this function in R called prccomp, and it's going to extract certain features from the data. It's going to use what's called principal component analysis. So let's take a look at what R is going to do to the data. So once again, we go back to the data and we try to visualize it. Even though we don't understand all the ins and outs of the R code, we don't understand all the ins and outs of the feature extraction, we can always go and look at what they're doing to the data in each step of the process as this is running. And this is what R is doing. So we started with the original data with the three columns. We then had about 4,000 or so features in the data. And R did something with those features, and instead it's returning 12 columns. Okay? These 12 columns essentially take those 4,000 or so features and they reduce them to about 12 very important features. And principal component analysis is trying to solve that problem. It says when you have data with lots and lots of features and you expect that some of the features are highly related to each other, right? And this is a very reasonable expectation, because if you have, let's say, in the raw text, the word technology and the word information, it could be that information technology appears together most of the time. And in that sense, we expect to see very highly correlated features in the data. All right, so it's going to take those 4,000 features, and it's going to return independent, a set of 12 independent features that we can use for the next step. So our next step is to take the data and to do k-means clustering. So we didn't talk about this, but this is the problem we're trying to solve. We have the raw text describing the data, and we want to see if we can use clustering to go into that raw text and to divide up the data into a certain number of clusters. Right? So k-means is the algorithm. We're going to train the data using k-means, and we're going to do it two different times. The first time, if I click on k-means, notice we're going to try to build two clusters. Right? Now, this number is kind of low. In practice, we probably want to start higher, but it's one of those things where we need to make some kind of decision. We need some kind of input. And so we're going to try two on one iteration, and we're going to try three for the other iteration, right? Let's try to build two clusters from the data, and let's try to build three clusters from the data, and then see if the clusters make sense. All right, so we train the data, and we can take a look at what is going to come out from the data set that the train model is going to return. And so when we build two clusters, first we have a visualization. This visualization is just going to show to what extent the clusters are independent or what sort of components they represent. And there is one last thing that we're going to do. So I'm going to come back to the R script here. Right, so we did principal component analysis. We started with the raw data. We had lots of features. We reduced them to about 12 features in the data. But R is also going to return some other results that I want to bring to your attention now. So if I go back to the R script and look at some results that it generated, one of them is this plot. So in Azure ML, we run R. If there are plots and visualizations that R is going to produce, they can also be returned in Azure ML for us to look at. And here we have this plot that kind of shows what happened with the principal component. It says one of the principal components is really, really big, very influential. It's present in almost all of the features, not all of the features, but let's say most of the features, right? So for us, it might seem like this is an important feature, but it's not. That's not what we're interested in, because this is probably something that most companies have in common. An example of that might be the word incorporated, right? Incorporated is not a good data point for this application because we're trying to separate companies out. We're trying to see which ones fall into the different industries. And because of that, this is a feature that's not very useful to us. The other features are very small in comparison, and so they probably capture more relevant information to what we're trying to accomplish. So the select column data set, what it's going to do is it's going to remove that first principal component. It's going to say, take that out, because if we want to build clusters, we probably don't want to look at that, and keep everything else. Right. Okay. And anyway, so we get two clusters, and we can take a look at the result of the... No, where is the... Edit metadata, result data set, and try to visualize the data that was returned. So here's the data with the name and the category of the company. Notice PC1 disappeared, but we have all the other features. And when the clustering algorithm ran, we now have a new column called assignments. So these are the predictions. These are sort of the way that the clusters were created. The first row of the data is Apple, and it fell into cluster 0. The next row is Adobe. Now, you would expect Apple and Adobe to fall into the same cluster, but in this case, they don't. Right? We can try building more clusters. We can try going back to the data and doing a better job of feature engineering. But if we don't do that, this is sort of what we have. Right? So we have all of these assignments, and we have kind of, we can examine this and see if we did a good job of separating, let's say in this case, IT companies from non-IT companies. We can look at the same result for the case when we have three clusters to see what happens. And when we build three clusters, yes, in this case, Apple and Adobe fall into the same cluster. And General Motors, General Electric, two companies that don't really have a lot of things in common. General Motors is a car company. General Electric is not a car company. But they fall into the same cluster, right? So we have these results. It's very hard to say if they're good or not. In this case, we really have to examine the data closely to get a better understanding. And that's one of the challenges of clustering. And unsupervised learning algorithms have this problem. Most of the time in this case was really spent on just doing this feature engineering, right? And so you can see the importance of feature engineering for this application. The last example I'm going to run is the one involving Titanic survivors. Right? So it's another experiment on Azure ML. I'm going to open it in the studio. Let me actually I already had one open, and I'm just going to use that. It's easier. Okay. So this is another machine learning experiment. We start with some raw data. In this case, the data is about Titanic passengers. We can take a brief look at the data, and we can see information about passengers, if they survived or didn't survive, information about class, names, sex, age, and so on. So this is the model that this is the data that we have, and the model that we could build is basically a model that tries to predict who is going to survive and who's not. There is quite a bit of, once again, pre-processing involved to clean some missing data, to get the data ready, and we're going to look at two algorithms in this case. So let me just run this quickly. The first algorithm on the left, I can zoom in a little bit, so we can see that better. So the first one on the left is a two-class boosted decision tree. And the one on the right is a support vector machine. We can evaluate the models to see which one is doing a better job of predicting. And this should look familiar. We did something similar to this yesterday. We have these two ROC curves. And in this case, probably the red one is better. They're both pretty close to each other, right? Both of these are relatively complex models, right? So if we care about complexity, if we care about building models that do a good job of making predictions, they're good candidates to use. I'm going to take out the support vector machine, and I'm going to include a forest. So we have a two-class decision forest. I'm going to drag it in and drop it in here, attach it to train model, and then I'm going to click on forest and look at the properties. Well, it says here, what is the number of decision forests that we want to build? So let me simplify this. I'm just going to make it one, so it's going to be a tree. And then there is a question about the maximum depth of the tree. 32 seems pretty high. If I care about explainability, I'm going to probably change that to, let's say, 5. And I'm going to run the algorithm now. Right. So we have on the left a very complex algorithm, a boosted tree. It's going to run multiple trees. It's going to do some computation. It's going to try to do a good job of predicting. And then we have on the right a simple decision tree. This one is just going to sift through the data once, and it's going to give me a tree. It's not going to be very deep, and I can probably visualize it and try to understand the predictions. Okay, so we have our model. We can go to visualize, and we can see that we have one tree, and this is pretty much what it looks like. It's just going to take a minute to load. And I'm going to zoom in and start at the top. Okay, so if we want to see who's going to survive the Titanic, the first and most important piece of information to look at is gender, right? And that sort of makes sense. Women were evacuated first and then men, so gender is an important variable in here. The next thing we're going to look at, well, we have to see how we separate male and female, but we can just start at some point and just keep going down the tree. And let's say in this case, we're going to look at fare price, right? So if your fare price is high or low, there is a differentiation going on there. Age is in there. Sibling, spouse, parent, child, all of these are important relationships. And at the end, we end up looking at a probability, and that probability is the probability that we're going to survive. Right? And so we have a simple decision tree. It's explainable, right? It might not be the best at doing predictions. It's going to be fast because it's a simple tree. It's probably going to have much less computational overhead than the boosted tree. We can look at a quick comparison of the two. right? It looks like this tree is actually not doing a bad job of predicting anyway, right? So in terms of evaluation, in terms of accuracy, it's actually not that bad compared to a complex model like a boosted tree. So anyway, there's different options for us to play with. I looked at a boosted tree and a decision tree, but we can compare that to logistic regression and other things. We're running out of time, so I don't think I can run any more examples. Hopefully, you know, you gained an appreciation for all of the things that we should keep in the back of our mind as we look at different models, right? And it's definitely not just about the process of dragging and dropping models into Azure Machine Learning and just playing with the different models to see which one is more accurate, but also thinking about the data processing that has to happen and thinking about the way that the models have to be deployed in production for them to be very effective. So thank you very much.